Welcome to episode 21 of Accidental Apprentice Podcast. It's Adam Melnick here, and this episode I bring to you something a little bit different. I have two faculty members from Sheridan College from the Industrial Millwright program, and I had Craig and Larry sit down with me, and I actually had them sit down with me in front of a live audience. We had a bunch of students, some other faculty, some administrative people from the college came in and enjoyed us in the podcast. There's actually a Q&A session, so we got some questions that came directly from the conversation we were having, which was really cool. And yeah, that's really about it. I don't have a whole lot to say about this episode. It's pretty deep. There's lots going on, and we kind of jump right into it, which was really cool. I just want to thank Sheridan College for the opportunity and the space and the time and the promotion. They helped share some of that. And from this, we've actually got another event coming up that is being advertised and is in conjunction with a bunch of the employers across the region. So we're doing an event where I will be live with Sheridan College in about a month or so. The date, I don't have locked down completely yet, but I'm super excited to do this in conjunction with them and actually feature some of the employers and dig deeper into those industries that are looking for bright, talented, innovative minds and to dig into what those industries actually do in the world and how people could find meaningful and awesome jobs with them and basically how to get there, because that's part of the deal is exploring the world of work, exploring unique careers and opportunities and coming to you and giving you the details of how to get from where you are to where those opportunities are and what kind of life and what kind of world that'll be doing that type of job. So anyways, without any further ado, episode 21, Accidental Apprentice Podcast, was recorded live at Sheridan College. And here is instructors Craig and Larry from the Millwright program in the Skilled Trade Center. Welcome to another episode of Accidental Apprentice, Odd Jobs Explored, with your host, Adam Melnick. Another episode of Accidental Apprentice Podcast, a very special episode. We are here at Sheridan College, which this was an idea that was dreamed about and quite frankly, I never thought would actually come into fruition. And then of course, through guests on the podcast and people's affinity to helping each other learn about the world of careers and the world of work and opportunity, it happened in less than 5 months and I'm still trying to master how this is all going to come together. So audio quality looks like it's going to be pretty good. I don't know because I'm not a sound engineer and I can't hear what we're doing other than each other. So, but the little bars are moving, so I trust in that and we go from there. Snuffle from the guys sitting in the room listening to this live. So I do have a live audience. If we hear some weird noises in the background or anything goes wrong, it's their fault. And we'll just remember that as we move through. So anyways, I am here with two professors, instructors. How do you guys like to be called? Professors or instructors?
Actually, I prefer instructor because I think we're not just in university basically dispensing information. We're actually instructing people on how to actually do things. So personally, I prefer instructor.
Nice. Craig?
And I agree with Larry. I prefer to be an instructor too because just I don't have a quilted jacket with leather things on the elbows or smoke a pipe.
Or smoke a pipe? That's a requirement. I do think that's a requirement. Okay, so I have Larry and Craig. You guys have been here at Sheridan College for collectively, how long have you both been teaching here at Sheridan College?
17 years.
17 years? 17th year, yeah. Larry?
Now I've been here for 11 years.
11 years. So there is 28 years of trade knowledge transfer just at the educational level. And what I'm going to get these guys to dig into a little bit here is we're going to dig into actually how the heck they got here, why they're here. What trade designations do you hold, or what is your history with the skilled trades, Larry?
Okay, I have over 25 years working in the trades. I have my certificate as a general machinist, tool and die maker, and industrial mechanic millwright.
So not just one ticket.
So I have three.
Nice. Well done, Craig.
Yeah, unfortunately, I only have one ticket, and that's an industrial mechanic millwright. That's it.
Listen, you're talking to a guy who has a heat and frost insulator ticket. People don't even know what that is. At least you can say what yours is, and people kind of go, yeah, right on. Yeah, I got a bit of an idea. Not a lot. I'm sure the assumption is. What's the main assumption or stigma that people have that a millwright does?
We are the trade that nobody knows about, but that everybody needs.
And so you guys here are both instructors with which programs?
So I'm involved with the Industrial Mechanic Millwright program, primarily. That's it.
That's it?
Yeah.
Larry?
And I usually teach about half precision machining and half millwrighting.
We got all kinds of interesting things I want to get into. So let me start, Larry. When you were, I'm going to take you way back, okay? When you were in high school or getting ready for that conversation about what am I going to do next, what was it you wanted to do?
Originally, I actually wanted to get into basically marine or engineering of ships, design work. Family business actually was a machine shop, so I'd already been working in the machine shop. And basically, I just decided I wanted to stay with the company, and so I went into machining. We were a jobbing shop, so we also did some tool die work. We also did a lot of maintenance work, so hence the three different trades.
Craig?
For me, believe it or not, back in Ireland in 1979, the day before I was due to go back to school for grade 11, honest to God, the telegram arrived to tell me that I actually got into the government training center as an apprentice industrial mechanic millwright. So I was 15.
And so you're a graduate of a much different system. You did your trades overseas?
Correct.
Okay. So Larry, you moved into the family business essentially. You had the affinity to be around machining. Where did you go next? Did you stay there the whole time, or did you find yourself moving around with your career?
I actually stayed with the company, like I said, for over 25 years. Then basically got to a point in my life where I did want to change. And it was either go into psychology, because I'd already been analyzing all my friends for free. Or I also do a lot of freelance theater work. So going to theater or into teaching, because again, working in the shop, working with apprentices, I was teaching people already, and a lot of my friends said I would do very well as a teacher. Psychology, I realized the only people that made really big money were the ones that had the PhDs. It was about an 11-year process, so at that point, my life wasn't practical. So then I actually tried theater, and anyone in professional theater said, you do know you cannot make money in theater. So after a year of running my own productions, I agreed with them. I'd been able to pay everyone with the exception of myself.
You have a good heart then.
There you go. Then I basically went to Mohawk College to see if I could link up with a coordinator or a chairperson there to see about the possibility of going into teaching rather than just going through HR. Left a message with the chairperson for the precision machining department and millwrighting department. Didn't hear back from them. So I figured I'd have to go with HR. Month later, I get this call saying, I've been looking all over. I had your phone number, but I lost it. I've got it again. Can you come in for an interview? All I wanted to do was find out, what do I have to do in additional training in order to be an instructor at the college level? That's all I really wanted. So I have this meeting with this individual, with their coordinator. About 5 minutes into the interview, I hadn't even asked to see, you know, what do I have to do to become an instructor. I realized with my 25 years of experience, unless I had shown up and I was either green or had like eight arms, they offered me two different positions right off the hop.
Wow.
And the rest is history.
And I'm just going to look to you guys. You guys, have you heard this? This is really important. And this is really, really important. Like, I always share one of the stories. I put it on my bio, and I love putting it on my bio, was that I was a professor of health and safety at Fleming College in Peterborough. It was like 4 months, and I got the job, very similar. Please apply. I looked down and went, I took some safety training. I have an instructor credential because I was on a job site where they needed someone to teach it and stand there and talk to you about Wimmis and fall protection, which was now working at Heights. And I didn't mind doing it. So I did it, got my instructor ticket, and I'll tell you right now, that instructor ticket I got from my employer turned me into a, and it was their designation for professor. That's why I kept it, because it was a fun conversation. There's no way you're a professor. And I was a professor of health and safety for 6 months in a college environment. The practical experience and element that comes from the trades is transferable, right? Let's not forget, trades are birthed and housed in the world of, you know, training and transfer and apprenticeship, and it's always about learning and always about moving forward, and it's always about transfer of information. So Craig, I'm going to come back to you for a second. So you get the letter in the mail and you now have a path, you have a goal, you have something in that. And is that what you really wanted to do? Like, you had your, you obviously applied for it, so you must have had your mindset on it.
It was something that I really enjoyed doing, because in the high school that I attended back in Ireland, we were very lucky. We had carpentry, metalwork, technical drawing. So those technical programs were there, and I really enjoyed doing the metalwork and the technical drawing. So yeah, I guess it was a path that I always liked. And really what tweaked me into it was my uncle, my dad's brother, he brought me to Aer Lingus, which is the national airline back in Ireland. And he brought us, myself and this other young lad, for a tour of the maintenance shops. And I saw this guy on a semi-automatic lathe sitting there with the reading the paper, smoking a cigarette. And I thought, I could do that, not having any idea of what the trade was actually about. So that first year then was what they call off-the-job training. So it was a government training program. And from after the end of that first year, then I got a job in a contract shop, a jobbing shop. And I was incredibly lucky there, because they had tool and die shop, welding and fabrication, and then maintenance, very similar to what Larry had. And so we were out all the time on different job sites, different factories. We did all sorts of refurbishment work for updating equipment. And so I was incredibly lucky. No 2 days were ever the same.
Now, this is a question for both of you, and you can take a turn however you want. But I do believe that every new person into a skill trade runs across a few things. One, they're going to be incredibly surprised on something. Some sort of expectation. So what was your, in your early years, if you guys think back to this, in your early years, what was your biggest pleasant surprise at your, this is great, this is so neat, I didn't know I'd get to do this? And also, what was, oh my God, I have to do this? What was the most pleasant, and what was most, maybe the most distressing surprises you guys had in your early years?
For me, working in a jobbing shop, there's such a variety of different jobs that come in. It can be incredibly challenging. So for me, what was most enjoyable was having an incredible challenge to figure out how to get a piece of equipment to do something it was never intended to do. So a huge plus to be able to meet that challenge. And the flip side would be having a piece of equipment in and not being able to figure out how to get it to do something it wasn't intended to do. So it was actually a double-edged sword. If you could get something very, very complex and actually fix it, great. If you couldn't, not so good.
For me, the biggest surprise was the amount of preparation that you had to do to get a job done. It's like kind of, we talk to the guys about this all the time, it's all in the preparation. Doing the job is the easy part, but the preparation and then the satisfaction after you've done the prep and then getting the job done and then have that piece of equipment work, and then knowing that when you leave that place where you've just spent a month or 6 weeks or a day, that piece of equipment is now doing what it's supposed to do.
Over the years, we know trades change, technology changes. In your opinions, guys, so what's been the biggest changes across you've seen so far in the world of industrial millwrights and machining? So,
I think the biggest advantage for the millwrights is access to information, be able to go online and actually get information that when I started in the trade that just was not available. So that's, again, both a blessing and a curse, because if I get a brand new student, they think everything they ever want to need to know will be online, and they don't have to actually learn anything. They'll just go online and it will explain it all. I point out that if you're constantly Googling everything, at some point Your boss is going to go ballistic. Grab your cell phone, throw it on ground, stomp on it, and say, no, you actually have to learn something. You have to have knowledge that you're not constantly looking it up. Another huge advantage for millwrights is digital photography. If they have to dismantle something, they can just take picture after picture, stage after stage as they dismantle it. I remember one job I had to dismantle something. I carefully laid it out all in line on the floor so I knew how to put it back together. Next day came in and it was all packaged up nicely for me in a crate. I would have loved to have had pictures of that.
Oh man, I can't imagine. I feel like that's something I would do as an instructor. But anyways, Craig, your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with most of what Larry said. But even when I look at the guys when they're doing what they do, and with the phones are just, like when you look at a cell phone now and they're so powerful, like those cell phones could have put the first rocket into space. Like it's incredible. And the advantage that they have, if it's used properly, it's an amazing, amazing tool for sure.
Yeah, and I go back to the blessing and curse piece. It's that access to information, knowing we have the knowledge, sometimes makes us reluctant to like, look, okay, I didn't get it right now. That's all right. I'll dig into it later. But there's an extreme value at the time, particularly when you know you have students in shop environments. You really want to put that time into essentially make those mistakes there in those shop environments here. So that way in the field, you have that retained knowledge, or at least you remember the things that didn't work. Sometimes that's really important too, right?
Well, it's safe here, right?
Yes.
It's a safe place to make mistakes.
Absolutely. Now, we know right now that it's pretty prevalent that we are looking at a labor shortage. There's mixed opinions across, I think, a lot of the trade sectors. There's debates on how big of an impact this is or it isn't. And I mean, it only takes the average person to look around the general populace and say, you know what? Yeah, the world of work is changing. There is a large population that is going to be retiring or hopefully trying to retire. And people need to take those jobs on 100%. And some people are doing it and exploring and some aren't. I got to dig into this a little bit because you guys have seen the evolution of your career and then the evolution of the trade. And then having spent the collective 28 years in the education system, particularly teaching, you must have identified this problem. Let me ask you, did you see this problem coming?
The shortage?
Yeah.
Well, I came to this country in 1988 and I got into Canada because they had a shortage and the shortage is still there. So it's never gone away. It just peaks every few years. They need more now than they did 5 years ago, for example. Okay. And you're right, with that, with people, more and more people retiring now, it just means there's more and more opportunities for individuals like the lads or people who are coming into the trade.
And Larry, I mean, you've been in Canada the whole time for your trade, right?
Yes.
So have you been hearing the same cries over the years that we're always in demand, that we always need more labor? Or do you remember times where if people were trying to advertise maybe that they were flush?
Okay, 45 years ago when I started in the trades, there was a shortage. Again, as Craig said, there has always been a shortage. There is no country in the world that advertises they have a surplus of tradespeople. A tradesperson can work anywhere in the world. You have more job security than pretty much any other field you can go into. So going into the trades, unfortunately, in Europe, they're much more appreciated than in North America. In Europe, if a parent can get their child into the trades, they're doing cartwheels because they know they're set for life.
With this shortage or perceived shortage, I call it perceived because I just feel like it's always been prevalent. It's always a conversation that we don't have enough people. And I'm wondering, is that the polite framework for we haven't fixed the stigma around the concept of being a tradesperson? You mentioned Europe. You mentioned Europe, and there's a sense of pride that a trade is. I refer to something I read before where university was a silo, college was a silo, and apprenticeship was a silo. And what I mean that is that they are streams, there are opportunities. There's a world of careers that existed around each of those pathways, and some may brush with each other, but the reality is they have careers, and they're of all equal value. And the pay scale will show it. The world of sustainability will show it. Opportunity. It's all there. And what happens is society kind of treats it as a balance and not one is less than the other. I don't think we could refer to that system here in North America, specifically Canada. I don't think that system exists. We have a hierarchy. We have university is the principal premium opportunity. You need to have a BA to apply to work at Starbucks nowadays. College is all right if you can use it and use some accreditation from the college experience to get your BA. Apprenticeship is what? It's kind of where that conversation goes. What's your view on the stigma? Why are people still holding on to this? Why do they have a negative connotation in your experience with the trade still?
I think as a general statement, parents always want to try and do better by their kids. And I think the perception is that if they, you know, go to university or go to college, that they'll be better than they were. But the reality is, as Larry touched on earlier on, and all this, the people that we have here in the room, you can make a nice living as a tradesperson, no matter where you are in the world. The reality is that, you know, everybody can't be a doctor or everybody can't be a lawyer. We need people to fix stuff. And that's the reality, because if we don't have people to fix stuff, the world as we know it will stop. It's as simple as that.
Any thoughts on that, Larry?
Unfortunately, the perception where the trades are concerned, it's if Billy isn't doing very well in school, they can always go into the trades. They can become a tradesperson. Seems to be the mentality that most of the adults in North America seem to have. When I run across that, I'll usually say to the individual, have you ever been in a jet airliner? Oh, yeah. Do you think they're complicated? Oh, for sure. Incredibly complicated. So you'd have to really know a lot about them. Well, yes. Who do you think builds them and maintains them? That's when they all of a sudden they do a double check and it's, oh. So do you think the person that's basically building it, fixing it, has to be really, really smart? Oh, for sure. So they have to know a great deal. Oh, yes. So do you really want the village idiot basically maintaining the aircraft you're going to go up several thousand feet? Oh, I guess not. I've known instances in companies where an entire engineering department has basically designed, had a piece of equipment built, and they cannot get it to work. The owner of the company comes out, God has his entire engineering staff, gets one of his people, says, okay, go get Otto, the crazy-looking old guy in the back, to come out, the millwright, and Otto comes out. They start up the machine. He watches it. Okay, he says, what you need to do is this over there. The engineers say, well, how can you prove it? Because whenever this problem occurs, I know if you do this over there, it will fix it. Turns to the engineers, he says, just do what he says. You've got to get this working. So I have known millwrights that are absolute geniuses. They're brilliant. They can basically design and engineer something that an engineering department cannot.
You touched on something amazing. I recently spoke with a gentleman from Promation Nuclear, and he himself is an engineer. And he went from design engineering into actual, I guess, I don't know how to refer to it, but he was actually making machining, right? He was getting into that world of machining. And he said how absolutely crucial the success of the engineering industry is that the engineers cannot be just theoretical or design-based. If they do not get their hands into things, we're going to have a bigger and bigger gap, and it's a bigger problem. And the value of the folks that are taking the time to learn and develop and design with their hands touching the products and touching the process and the machines, and that is going to be what saves a lot of industry when we don't have enough people coming. That was a pretty big statement, but you really just kind of pulled that out of me thinking the conversation he had, and I thought it resonated, but you're giving a perfect living example of that happening, and it happens often. Because the entrance to trades for many, many years, and still for many trades, is still held that you only need a grade 10, and in some cases you did need your grade 12 diploma, but there were trade opportunities and apprenticeship opportunities that allowed you to have it at a grade 10. Do you think that contributes to the stigma?
That we just drag our knuckles on the ground?
Yeah, that is really easy to get into, that if you can't do anything else is a great place to land because you only need a grade 10. What's the misconception there?
Larry touched on it, like the thing, what we all do, you have to be incredibly smart to do this job. You have to be able to think outside the box. You have to be able to work on your own, and you have to be able to work as part of a team. And to do those things, it's very, very difficult. And you're working in all sorts of extreme conditions, outside, inside, hot, cold, hanging off a machine 50, 60 feet up in the air. It's very rewarding, but very dangerous work as well. And I think the reality is that people have to understand that. It's like if you say to somebody, oh, well, I'm a heart surgeon. Oh, that's awesome. Well, I'm an industrial mechanic millwright. What? You know, like really and truly, it's that whole misconception of, well, you're just whatever. It's wrong. It's totally wrong.
And I'm going to take you back into the advocacy or promotion conversation, because I know you do a lot of work, and Sheridan does a lot of work at helping explore that on a bigger scale. We're going to come back to that. I just want to ask a bit of a harder question, maybe, that do you think if, because there's still a lot of apprenticeship in Ontario that still has the availability that you could enter that apprenticeship with only a grade 10. Do you think that if we or the government actually changes that requirement, so all apprenticeships need to have a grade 12, do you think it'll help change some public perception? Or do you think it'll be more trouble than it's worth?
It might actually help the public perception, but the problem we run into as well is you'll have somebody going through school, and if they're the same as me, most of what I was being taught in school, I realized I had absolutely no use for. Biggest thing I would never have any use for during my life would be math. Now I find it's one of the most useful tools I've actually got. You can't get through life without math. So I wouldn't want to basically exclude some students that down the road would now appreciate what their education actually is worth. And something as well Craig was talking about, like not everyone can be a doctor, can be a surgeon. The problem to perception-wise, in the movies, you see what a surgeon does. You see what a lawyer does. Nobody sees what a millwright does. Nobody sees what a machinist does. Even when a plumber comes to your house, they go and do their thing, and miraculously, all the plumbing's working again. So the problem is we don't have that visual perception.
Craig, your thoughts?
I think from a perception perspective, a huge job can be done. You touched on it earlier on with guidance counselors. I think from the grassroots, and I think one of the biggest mistakes that was made, and I will say this until I'm pushing daisies up, is the fact that in grade school, they took away design and technology. This was a way to introduce boys and girls to, you know, a hammer or a saw or a bandsaw or a drill, just to get that spark going in their mind. And then they would go to high school, or they may think, okay, I'm going to go to a high school that has technology courses and not just go to a strictly academic high school. I think that was a massive mistake by the government taking that away for the most part. And I think guidance counselors have a huge job to play in that, if they have the right information to give those kids that really don't know where they want to go and give them options to say, well, you know, have you thought about doing this? Whether it be a plumber or a motor mechanic or an electrician or a millwright or a toolmaker or whatever. But, you know, not just to go to school to go to school for the sake of going to school, but to, as you touched on as well earlier on, do something that will, you know, give them satisfaction every day, which is huge.
No, that's, it's hard to identify that early on. And I mean, I've got kids that are 12 and 10, and the concept of trying to say as a parent, define things they like or are interested in to explore, it's, you can hear other people kind of judge you and say, well, they're 12 and 10, like they're too young. But this is, we're always in this evolution of finding things we like. You know, I don't put my time into doing this stuff with the podcast because it's just good for other people. I enjoy this, you know, exploring this type of conversation. Maybe I would have done something different on the way through, and that's fine. Well, we're going to have that evolution. But if we're not getting the opportunity to try, what we tend to have is a bunch of people working in glass towers that are looking out the window, wishing they were doing something else. They're not even 100% sure what that is. They find it when they're 40, And that's not always the worst thing in the world, but it is certainly challenging at that point in the world. Changing careers is challenging for anyone. Now, once you're in a trade, changing from one trade to another is a different conversation. It tends to be a little bit easier. It tends to have opportunity. And often, because you have a trade, another opportunity for another one comes along. And I don't think that's a message shared enough. And another message I'm going to ask you guys a little bit about, which should be education for me as well. When we are talking about advocacy and we're championing our craft, and many of you in the room here are going to become champions of your craft, one of the best conversations you could ever have with anybody who doesn't know much about your own trade is about the opportunities past your ticket. And this is something that we don't share enough of. So once you get your trade ticket, there is a world of opportunity. There's so many different things you can do. Can you guys maybe link or describe a few ideas or scenarios or places or things that people could be doing with a machinist or a millwrighting ticket?
Well, for myself, as I mentioned, I do some work with community theater. I was also doing, for a while, freelance theater work where I was actually generating a living from it on the technical side, not my own productions. But as working as a theater technician, I could make very, very good money there. There is no community theater that's going to say they have too many tech people. Actors? Yeah, they've got all kinds of those. But if you want to do basically work in the arts and theater and you have a technical background, yes, you're actually sought out.
Hold on. So you can take a trade. And any and this works for a lot of trades, but I'm going to feel probably a little more confident that machining and millwrights, you're probably going to get a way deeper technical exposure. And other trades out there, if you think you have a better, get a hold of me. You'll come on the show and explain otherwise. But I think you have a deeper berth of things that you're going across as a spectrum to provide opportunities to go into completely different fields. I was having a conversation the other day where I was the gentleman from the esports I was telling you about. And he talked about how so many people want to get into the world of production of television, film, what have you. They have this burning passion. They get there and they're horrible. But what they are good at is maybe they're really good at math. And all of a sudden they become a chartered accountant for the production company. And they're still in that world, but they're doing a different task. You know, skilled trades is a key, I think, to a door of many, many opportunities. And you can be in any field working in it. And, let's see, Craig, what do you think about the ideas of things that could be past the ticket? Once you get the ticket, what other things could people explore? Career opportunities or hierarchies or what have you?
Well, I think with the trade that the apprentices sitting here today, the huge advantage that they have is if you went around the room, there would be so many different industries that they're in, and this particular trade that they've chosen to make a living from, like every single industry on the face of this planet needs us. We absolutely, so it could be oil and gas, it could be pharmaceutical, it could be manufacturing, like every single thing, nuclear, it could anything. It every single one of those trades, we are in there. So if they finish their ticket and they do, if they're in a pharmaceutical company, for example, and an opportunity comes up in oil and gas, they can apply for that. So that's the flexibility that they have with their trade is absolutely outstanding. They're not a one-trick pony.
Yeah, you're not defined by an industry. You're not defined by a sector by any means. It's a ticket that, you know, it's called a journeyman ticket for a reason. Is because you can move and you can move around and you can move across countries. You can move across industries. It is really a ticket to travel, and that's why it's called journeyman. It's not because it's some branding thing they did long time ago, decades ago. It's because the rationale is that you're going to be on the move with it. You're going to go where the work is. And so you will be journeying and you'll be traveling. I want to take a trip over to advocacy and promotion. So I know Sheridan is heavily involved with Skills Ontario, the stuff you guys do, training. And I really have to point out here, folks, as we get in this conversation, what you're going to find out is the work that's being done with these millwright apprentices and students through the programs here at Sheridan. This isn't just the basic level stuff. They're getting into some pretty crazy things. And I'm going to ask you guys to explain a little bit of the work you guys are doing in terms of advocacy, outreach, you know, breaking a little bit around that stigma and creating a little bit of deeper awareness for what the opportunities are?
From my own personal experience, for the last 10 years, I've been incredibly fortunate to, I've been working with Skills Ontario and Skills Canada for the last 10 years. And for the last 6 years, I've been involved with the World Skills Organization. And last year, we started our own in-house Skills Sheridan competition. So we're into our second run of this wonderful enterprise this coming March. And the nice thing about this competition this year will be it'll be the whole college. Last year was just to the skilled trades. So that's going to open up to the whole college. And with the stuff that I've done at Skills Ontario and Skills Canada and World Skills, it's been an incredible journey where I've met some amazing people and had some unbelievable experiences from every level, with just the individuals who are involved in the competitions, the competitors, to their trainers, to the experts, and then the individuals from different institutions that you meet, and the swapping of ideas from a curriculum perspective to projects, and just the way that you deliver what you do has just been absolutely amazing. And every time that I've gone out, and when we're involved in a competition, and you have the young boys and girls that come along at Skills Ontario, for example, and they ask you questions when you're standing at the side of the rail and they're looking in at the competition, just to see their eyes light up when they see female and male competitors doing their thing. Like, what are they doing there? Why are they doing that? Where could that be used? It's just amazing. Just that spark goes off. It's really, really cool.
Do you guys feel that there's a need as part of your curriculum, part of your teaching, to instill a little bit of, I refer to it as championing. It could be being the poster children of the trade. Do you feel there's a need to have that as part of the education process with your participants?
For them to be, after the competition is over,
Even at large, even just the students we have here in the classroom and the people you've taught over the years and will continue to teach, is it important? Do you feel it's important to get them to be champions and advocates as well?
Oh, totally. Like these guys here, they're amazing. They're absolutely amazing, because the nice thing about what we do is, for the most part, you get to know them over 3 years. Because we think they like us, they come back every year. Because we're doing two things. We're giving them an education, but what we're providing for them through the facilities is a means to put into practice the theoretical learning that we're giving them. But these guys, when they go back to work every week, you know, they're talking about what they're doing here at Sheridan. So vicariously, they're telling the world what we do here. So they're selling us, and we don't even know it.
That's fantastic.
Hopefully well.
So I'm going to give one more question that I've got for you guys. And then I'll look out to you guys here in the room, that if you have any questions, I really would encourage you, because this is like the off the hook moment where you get to have them at your will and you can ask what you want, because we have it recorded. So they're going to have to answer somewhat nice to you. There's the laugh. I told you, as a training instructor, I know how the answers go. I want to ask you guys, over the evolution of your careers and as instructors, and seeing the apprentices continue to come and shaping journeymen of tomorrow and journeymen and women of tomorrow, how have the challenges and roadblocks across skilled trade apprenticeships, and specifically we'll talk millwright and machinist, how have the challenges and roadblocks changed, and what ones still seem to be the same?
I think our biggest roadblock, we've talked before, Craig's mentioned about like the guidance counselors in the schools. Whenever we've had guidance counselors come in from elementary schools and they actually see what we're doing here in the trades, almost to the last one of them, they are absolutely amazed at what our students are doing. They can't believe the knowledge base they have. What they're actually capable of doing, how diverse the trades are, how exciting things are. They're almost literally to a person blown away. But every time we get a new group in, they're all just have no idea what we actually do. So we've got that stigma that we keep running across, and as much as possible, whenever we can get guidance counselors in here, like I said, we just blow them away with what we're actually capable of doing.
And I think as well, and the guys in the class could back me up in this in certain situations, that I think from an industry perspective, industry needs to understand that this is an important part of the journey for the apprentices, both male and female, as they travel from their first year to ultimately their ticket and then to be qualified tradespeople, that this is a necessary evil and it has to be done, because when they became tradespeople, they had to go to school. And sometimes I think they forget where they came from. And I think it's really important that they support their apprentices when they come to school, because it's a win-win. The apprentices are getting an education which is going to help them be better in the job that they do every day.
Anyone got anything they want to throw at your instructors while you got them free? I'll reword that. Okay, so hold on, we'll get that. Actually, let me get you this way, a 15-foot mic cord.
Do you see school in the next few years changing to more of a practical base or more theory-based, and how do you guys see it to make it better?
There's talk that possibly the industrial mechanic millwright program may be going to a 4 in-school session, but that's all up in the air right now. There is talk afoot, or changes possibly afoot, which I think would be a wonderful thing, because I think every day that you're in school is a good day, because it means that you learn more about your craft, that you know, just to hone those skills that you may be doing on a daily basis, more theoretical knowledge, more practical opportunities with what you do. And like, no system is perfect. You know, back home, before I came to Canada, it was a 4-year apprenticeship and I went to school every year 4 times. You guys here were the only province in the country that has 3 in-school sessions. Everywhere else has 4. And there's a reason for that. It's to try and make you better at what you do in your craft, regardless of what the trade is. Will it happen? I surely hope it does. Obviously, you guys will be down the road, all ticketed, wonderful tradespeople. But, you know, I hope that it does happen for sure.
The other big challenge, theoretical as opposed to practical. With practical, you need more floor space, you need shop space, you need shop equipment. Fortunately here, we're very, very well supported in that. I'm sure even you gentlemen have noticed that in the 3 years you've been here, there's more equipment every year. So fortunately, Sheridan is supporting us in getting us more equipment, better equipment, to give you more of a hands-on experience. And we definitely have to keep that going forward.
And just to add to that, like, we've been incredibly lucky here as well with, Larry just touched on it, with the support that we've had from administration, because also in Ontario, the government over the last number of years have had the Apprenticeship Enhancement Fund, or the AEF Fund, and with the support of administration here in supporting faculty in the equipment that we want, that has been a win-win as well. So we've been very lucky that way too.
Anyone else, you guys? Yeah. I think that mic works. You guys stand up, though. You got to get on the show. It doesn't work any other way.
Okay. I was speaking with Craig the other day in class, and he was mentioning the CFQ and the CFA, right? In the industry right now, I noticed there's a bigger gap in terms of skill-wise with the guys who are CFQ licensed and CFA. Do you agree or disagree?
Well, they're two different things, right? The CFA is a certificate of apprenticeship, which basically states that you have done all 3 levels of school in Ontario and you've successfully completed each of those levels. The CFQ is your certificate of qualification, where you basically get your ticket, which says that you're now a ticketed journey person. So a lot of companies now are looking for both. They want to have their apprentices have done the school, have successfully completed it, and then also got their CFQ. Is there a gap from a theoretical to a practical perspective? It all depends on what industry you're in and how proactive the tradespeople are in the place that you work in trying to pass on the knowledge and experience that they have. And that's a challenge for all of you. And if you're in a place where you have that support, that's an amazing experience. But if you have the other side of the coin where you're basically fighting all the time to try and get that knowledge, because as we all know, time is the only thing that gives us experience. You can't buy that. You have to actually just do it. And time is the only thing that gives you that. So is there a gap? I think there, yeah, from a theoretical to a practical standpoint, yes, for sure.
All right, thanks for that. And anyone else? There's a couple ones covered. Okay, I end up drafting up. Oh, yeah, there's in the back. I feel like this is a loaded question.
No, it's not. Very fair So I feel like the trend nowadays is that the lines between what is, say, a manufacturing company where, say, a lot of our apprentices work in and what's a technology company is increasingly blurred, mainly because of the evolution of technology and, say, the Internet of Things and interconnected processes in a manufacturing facility. And it's not just manufacturing. It could be a logistics company, right? You look at Amazon, how automated they are. How can we as trades educators stay on the forefront of that? What should we be investing in? What are the next challenges that we should be looking at, tackling?
I think it's just a case of we really have to be educating the general public of the value of the trades. Again, computers can't do everything. The younger generation coming up thinks, yeah, it's all about computers. Computers can build anything. That's not the case. It takes people. So we really have to, as much as possible, educate the general population as to the value of tradespeople and the value of the skills that we're actually learning.
And I think industry relations are huge. Outreach from the colleges to industry that are local, and then through a local industry, they may be right across a province, for example, or right across the country. But I think relationships with industry are massive, absolutely huge, and very, very important.
It's those relationships with industry that help shape what you need to be teaching and learning for what's in demand out there. And that relationship that's maintained through the colleges and through the TDAs across the province, I think is what sets apprenticeship and apprenticeship training, in many cases, well ahead of those training in the maybe the world of university when they're talking about the BAs and that, because it's the relationships are deeper and more traditionally better rooted from the colleges and the TDAs, because it's industry driven training, and as maintaining that relationship and pushing it forward is paramount, absolutely is paramount. And I'm glad to hear that being reflected in this conversation. I mean, I didn't think otherwise. I knew you guys would be on top of that one as soon as the question was asked, and I appreciate that, and thank you for the questions. I'm going to wrap up with a couple little ones here for the sake of time. We talked about the gaps with the guidance counselors and teachers. Do we have any advice we can give them what they can currently do? Things you can think of right now that they could be doing to help solve a bit of that gap and to diversify their skill set and knowledge?
From a guidance counselor perspective and from a school board perspective, don't be afraid to ask the questions. Like, don't be afraid to say, okay, if it's a PD day, for example, have the guidance counselors come into an institution like this and spend, you know, half a day going through the different labs. Like, we're very fortunate. We got electrical, we got machining, we got millwriting, we got plumbing, and we got welding. So we got five specific trades in-house. So have them come in, see the students do their thing, talk to the professors, and then have that information. But don't be afraid to ask the questions.
That sounds like an open invitation. Perfect.
Yes, absolutely.
Any thoughts, Larry?
Exactly what Craig says. They have to actually come in and visually see what we're doing here. Because like I said, once they see it and appreciate it, they're all just blown away.
And there's outlets as well. I mean, Skills Ontario, you have the provincial competition. I know you guys house competitions. I'm going to hazard a pretty solid guess that social media, Facebook, all that wonderful stuff, the Sheridan websites, that stuff's out there to show this previous competitions, previous forays into all this exploration of advanced, I'm going to call it advanced, millwriting and machining, all that work you guys do. So don't forget to check those things out. We'll have all the links in the show notes. It'll all be in there as well. Do you guys do like an open house thing here in the skills department?
We, anytime anybody can call the office and they can set up an appointment. You can book a tour anytime you want, anytime. Everybody's more than welcome.
And I can actually hold that true because in the lining up time between Craig and I was the one who struggled with my schedule. It wasn't Craig. So that was, I know that's a pretty ease of access thing. And I'm going to close with one final question from you two. And that is basically, what do you guys have in mind for the hope for the future of the trade or the industry?
Since we are indispensable, the world will realize they have to have us. So there is hope because they can't live without us.
As the doctors of industry, we are totally indispensable.
I can't possibly think of another way to close. That was beautiful. Totally indispensable. Doctors of Industry. That's fantastic. Guys, I can't thank you enough. I really appreciate the time. Sheridan, the Trades Department, Larry, Craig, guys, for being quiet the whole time. I appreciate that. And with that, I mean, if you're not exploring skilled trades and this didn't push you in that direction to your mind is headed there, you know, dig a little deeper. Look at the stuff we've got. We've got things coming, and check the show notes. Check out Sheridan College and all the work they do here. I've walked through these facilities. I told you myself, I've taught in a couple of facilities. You know that. And I'm slightly envious of what's here and the availability at the fingertips of the students and apprentices who get to train here. This is a wonderful opportunity to explore skilled trades and get ready for a wonderful and amazing career, as you have heard on this show before. So thanks for another episode of Accidental Apprentice. I'm Adam, and I'll catch you guys later.